Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. In recent weeks, I've been doing a lot of studying of Rhodesian and South African history and related history because I want to continue with my race war stuff, and there is a very important set of videos that I want to finish, but it requires a lot of work. So in between doing the various things, I come across little stories, if I can call it that, which make for very interesting reading and study. And I want to show you what white people are really capable of. When whites live in Europe, when whites live in North America, and the majority of people around them are also white, they don't realize what they are really capable of and how different they really are to people like the blacks, for example. And what can a white man do when he goes all out? And these are the kinds of things that I want to show you. Now, some of you have seen my video about when the blacks tried to genocide all the Portuguese in Angola, and how the Portuguese civilians ended up killing the blacks left, right and center. I've discussed the Battle of Carmona and also that video about that Portuguese mother and her incredible bravery. But I want to show you in between the main topics, I want to tackle a couple of small topics in between, and this is going to be one of them, where I just show you what some white men have done all by themselves in Africa. And some of these whites are not, let's call it, colonials or whites who've got a long heritage of living in Africa. Some of these whites came straight out of Europe and got involved in black African wars, and you'll be amazed at what some of them did. And I will also discuss the deeper topic of whites sticking together versus whites working with non-whites. Because even among Rhodesians, even among Germans, there are debates and discussions about this. And if we go further back to the Roman Empire, we can maybe learn some lessons. But the story I want to tell you about here is a little story about a man whose identity I don't know. I can't find anything about this guy except in this book by a Rhodesian. So let me just very basically sketch the scenario without going into too much detail so that you just understand the context of this, and then you're going to see what this French pilot did and what an amazing guy he was. At the time that the British dumped their empire in Africa, and the British themselves are a topic of discussion, once the British dumped their empire in Africa, plus the Russians and Chinese were moving into Africa, it then triggered a whole bunch of wars. And some of those wars are really weird. They are unexpected wars that took place with very strange conditions. And one of those wars has to do with the Belgian Congo. The Belgians controlled this enormous rich territory called the Congo. So if you look at this map, you'll see this is a map of the Congo crisis of 1961. And this country, colored in green, blue, and red, this is the Belgian Congo. But now it's broken up, and the blacks are starting to fight each other. And what is of greatest importance here is the green portion at the bottom, which is Katanga. And Katanga had a lot of mines. And Katanga seceded from the Congo. And then, of course, the the United Nations stepped in. There are two wars in Southern Africa that occurred round about this time, where the whites picked one of the smaller sides as the side that they supported. One had to do with the war in Nigeria, which is in West Africa, and then here in this Congo war, the whites tended to side with Katanga. But in steps the United Nations, and the United Nations is an organization for whom I have nothing but the utmost contempt. The utmost contempt. In Africa, the United Nations has never once done anything for whites. And the United Nations always sides with Jewish communists, always sides with whoever is really the enemy of whites. So the United Nations then decided to destroy this black country that broke off, Katanga. Although Katanga, like I say, had whites supporting it. And the same is true in the Nigerian War. You'll see that in the Nigerian Civil War, the Biafrans broke away. And you'll also find whites piling in to help the Biafrans. And Rhodesia and South Africa supported the Biafrans. But you'll find that the United Nations, etc., is always on the side of the communists. They're always on the side of the worst of the blacks. So the United Nations then came and waged a war against Katanga, and eventually the Katangan secession failed. But for our purposes, we just want to take a quick look at this map of Katanga, and look near the bottom of the map. You'll see there's a town called Elizabethville. And Elizabethville is where the action takes place that I'm about to describe. The border directly to the south of Katanga is the country that at the time was known as Northern Rhodesia. It is now known as Zambia. And at that time, Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, and another country called Malawi were all joined together. And they were ruled by Southern Rhodesia. This is known as the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. It's a British creation. And at that time, with this fighting taking place in Katanga, you had the Rhodesian Army and also the Rhodesian Air Force traveling along the border and even flying into Katanga in order to ensure that fighting from Katanga doesn't spill over into Northern Rhodesia, that is Zambia. So what I'm about to read to you is the account as given by a Rhodesian pilot who flew in the area and was active in the area. And he tells the story of this French pilot. Now let me just also say another thing. Katanga, having whites coming to fight on their side, the black leader of Katanga also then had a couple of whites create a miniature air force. Now these miniature air forces and air forces in Africa is a very important topic. And in the case of the Rhodesian War, the Rhodesian Air Force becomes a very, very important topic. Now the finest air force in Africa controlled by whites was of course the South African Air Force. And the South African Air Force in its day was unmatched. There was nothing like it. It was the best air force, the finest aircraft, the best of everything. But what you're about to see is the other end of the scale. You're going to see a tiny hodgepodge effort, people just throwing things together quickly, making a plan and trying to make something work, and the results are excellent. So the Katangese had some whites who ran their little air force, and their air force was commanded at different times either by a South African or somebody from Europe. And these people from Europe are just loners who get in on the action. In fact, their main commander at the end is a guy of Polish-Swiss descent. So they have a couple of aircraft. They got mostly transport planes, but they got a few aircraft. And these whites are the pilots. And these tiny air forces are totally run by whites. And that's very important. You will not find in Africa any of these air forces that really get down to serious fighting. You will not find any of them really run by blacks. In those days, and right up to the time of the end of white rule in South Africa, the air forces absolutely exclusively whites only. So in the fighting that takes place in these black on black wars, where black armies are fighting other black armies, you'll find that the blacks have got an air force that is completely white. It's not a big air force, but it's completely and utterly white. So let me just read to you a little bit about the Katangese Air Force, and then I'm going to tell you about Max, the French pilot. And we don't know what his full name is. There's no other reference to him. But the Rhodesian account about Max is pretty amazing, and I think you'll have some good laughs. So this is from Wikipedia. Katangese Air Force. In 1960, the leader of the Konakat Party, Chombi is the black guy who seceded, declared Katanga Province's secession from Congo Leopoldville as the state of Katanga, after unrest elsewhere in the Congo and the failure to establish a federalist regime in the country. The newly formed Katangese government requested military aid from Belgium, while the Congolese state appealed for assistance to the United Nations. So let me just pause there. The Belgians have been kicked out, the Belgians are gone, but now the Katanga province that is breaking away is actually turning to its former colonial power, strange as it may seem. But anyway, they were more friendly to the whites. So while the rest of the country was appealing to the United Nations, Katanga, which broke away, is now asking Belgium for help. Not that it can expect much, because Belgians have already been massacred, Belgians have already been chased out. But the bottom line is that Katanga is much more friendly to whites, and it seeks whites to assist it. And like I say, Rhodesians and South Africans therefore see Katanga as being a friendlier black state worth supporting. And all of this is the weirdness of race war and racial conflict in Southern Africa and in Africa. And you'll see many things happening that run contrary to what Jews and liberals tell you about race. So let's continue. On 17th July 1960, United Nations Security Council Resolution 143 was adopted, which established the United Nations Operation in the Congo, ONUC, and would provide military assistance to the Congolese forces. So they're siding with the other blacks, and they're going to crush the secession. In August 1960, Chombi began to establish military and paramilitary formations under the auspices of the Katangese Gendarmerie. It was also intended to include a small air force established from aircraft formerly used by the colonial era Aviation Militaire de la Force Publique. Pardon my accent. Let me continue. It recruited mercenary pilots, including several veterans who had served in the Royal Air Force during World War II, such as the Polish fighter pilot Jan Zumbach. The primary role of the Katangese Air Force was to provide air support for ground troops and air interdiction. And the term air interdiction basically is bombing behind enemy lines. This is basically the kind of stuff that the British and Americans did with Germany. Bombing the civilians, bombing the factories, blowing up the railway lines, roads, bridges, etc. Initial aircraft consisted of 5 de Havilland Doves, 8 North American T-6 Texans, a de Havilland Heron, an Aerospatiale Alouette II helicopter, a Piper PA-18, and a single Sikorsky H-19 helicopter, which were left by the Belgian Air Force during the dissolution of the Belgian Congo. Additionally, 9 Fugger CM-170 Magisters were purchased from France in 1961, but only 3 of these were delivered. Furthermore, at least 6 German Dornier DO-28As were imported. The first reached Katanga in late August, with 4 more arriving in October. DO-28s were subsequently armed and used mostly for air-to-ground attacks. Based at Luano Airfield, Kolwezi, and several smaller airfields in the hinterland, the FAK supported the Katangese ground troops by raiding ONUC troops and positions on several occasions. Battles raged on for over 2 years between the Katangese and the UN contingent forces. Yet on 15th February 1963, the UN had finally established full control over Katanga. Remnants of the Katangese Air Force were all but gone, as most aircraft were destroyed or abandoned. Those that remained in the Congo were reintegrated into the Congolese Air Force. Then it talks about the commanders, and here you'll see white guys, Europeans. It was initially commanded by the Belgian Victor Volant. In September 1961, in the aftermath of Operation Rum Punch, Volant left Katanga and command devolved to the Katangese pilot Jean-Marie Ngoza. Now that sounds a bit like a black, but I'm not sure. And his Belgian advisor José de Lin. It sounds like there was a black pilot and he had a white advisor. But the whites play a major role, you'll see. In the aftermath of Operation Unocat in December 1961, command first changed over to the South African Jeremiah Cornelius Puren. Then in early 1962 to Jan Zumbach, that's the Polish guy, who commanded Avicat until the end of the Katangese secession in January 1963. I thought I would do a little bit of research on the Katangese Air Force because I was especially interested by a plane that I saw called a Fuga Magister, which you can see on the screen in front of you. And this strange looking plane, I was quite fascinated by it. I'm always fascinated by European engineering. And this particular plane that you see here, I was particularly fascinated by the type of tail wing on this thing. I was quite fascinated by the tail being inclined like that at an angle. And I went and did a bit of reading up on it. And this is actually a French jet trainer. This is one of the first jet trainers that was built after World War II. And so this is the first generation after piston-engined trainers. And it turns out that this training aircraft, as you can see there, it's got place for two people. So you've got the person learning as well as the instructor in the plane. And it turns out that this plane was used in Katanga. And the Katangan government ordered 9 of them, but only 3 of them actually arrived. And I managed to find out that one of them was piloted by a white guy who went into combat with it, and I'll tell you about that shortly. But just take a look at this strange design, and I quite enjoy strange designs and independent thinking. It's lovely stuff, European thinking, as people in our race are thinking and coming up with new ideas. I really quite enjoyed this thing. I'd never come across this plane before. And this plane is not meant for combat, but it was used for combat in Katanga. And in Africa, we used aircraft and helicopters that were not at all built for combat at all. We used helicopters and civilian aircraft in a combat role. Planes and helicopters that were never designed for actual combat, we used them in combat. And I'll tell you more about that later. But this one is definitely a military-style plane, so it's not even like some of the stuff Rhodesia did, where we took civilian aircraft and used them for combat. But I just want to show you a little bit about this Fuga Magister, some film footage about it, and you will see what kind of plane it is. And apparently that design of that plane is based on a glider. The original thinking behind it is a glider, and it's got some pretty weird features, this little plane. And it's got some efficiencies built into it. All these are European things that these non-whites wouldn't even think of. So just check out some of this film footage and it'll give you a bit of an insight into the strange design of this plane. Even the West Germans bought some of these planes initially, and the main places it seems to have seen combat was in the Israeli Six-Day War. And I don't like to use the Israelis as any kind of example of anything, but I managed to find that that is the only place where these planes really seem to have been used in combat in number. And it is claimed that they destroyed tanks. So just take a look at this video, which shows this aircraft, and you'll get a bit of an idea of some of the strange and interesting design features that came with this plane. Quite an interesting little plane.
Because we're checking out a Fuga Magister and its owner pilot. Richard?
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit about this.
This was the first generation jet trainer from transition from a piston to a jet. And after you transitioned through this aircraft, you went to a faster fighter type aircraft.
So in essence, this is like the French version of like a T-33.
That's correct.
All right,
that's
excellent. Correct. There's some funky things about this plane, let's just be honest. Let's go take a look at them close up.
Sure.
All right, Richard, I think I know what these are, but what are these?
These are air brakes, top and bottom.
No kidding. Oh, yeah.
More efficiency.
So And they just kind of fold in and out?
That's correct.
Are they manual?
No, they're electric over hydraulic.
Will they automatically deploy, or do you deploy them?
No, you have control of them on the power levers.
Looking at this wing, it's a really long wing for such kind of a small plane. This was actually designed from a glider.
That's correct. And it still has a 13-to-1 glide ratio at 140 knots.
Now, one of the things that harkens back to its glider heritage is that V-tail.
Right.
Let's go check that out.
Okay.
So, Richard, why the V-tail?
The V-tail has one less surface, and it makes it 20% more efficiency.
Now, something I picked up when we were walking over here is this tiny little tail wheel. What is going on with that thing?
That's a leftover from the glider days, and you can still roll on that after you land, so you use aerodynamic braking with the aircraft.
So literally you could come in like this and just land on that wheel.
You have to land first on the main, then you can rotate towards the tail.
Okay. And so it almost, so you're using it, your wings almost as a brake.
That's correct.
Okay. That is very cool.
All right. Light on our fuel.
Let's do it. Oh, this is gonna be awesome. My first jet ride. Is this pressurized?
Yeah, it's pressurized.
That's what I'm feeling.
Yep.
Delta following Simpson, right midfield downwind, runway 8, clear to land number 2.
Runway 8, clear to land number 2, 6407 Delta, looking.
Simpson 617 Charlie, runway 8, clear, touching good.
So tell me a little bit about this aircraft.
Well, it's a first generation training jets transition. First generation jets for transitioning from pistons to jets, and then they moved up from this to faster aircraft.
So what is our indicated airspeed? My French isn't that good.
Okay, we're doing 200 knots right now.
Okay. How often do you fly?
Oh, whenever I can. I fly professionally, so.
Oh, okay.
I fly about every week.
Do you fly this guy every week?
Oh, not this one. But.
Seems to be a pretty stable bird.
It is. Okay, we're going to swing down to our right here.
Oh, yeah, baby. Oh, yeah. Wow, that's quick. Holy cow. That is so cool. It's an odd sensation. It's not like flying in a piston engine aircraft for some reason. It's like you're just kind of sliding or gliding along. And I think that's because you don't get the shape of the propeller. And we're down. Woo! That was awesome, Richard. Thank you so much. We were really clipping along there.
Yes, you were.
I just want to read to you quickly a bit about what was done with the Fuga Magister, also by a white pilot. And this is just from Wikipedia. It says, Katanga. During the Congo crisis, the pro-secessionist Katangese Air Force, FAK, purchased 9 newly built Magisters, set aside from a Belgian order. Only 3 were delivered to Katanga in February 1961. One of these was used against the ONUC in the September 1961 siege of Jadotville, flown by a Belgian and armed with 2 machine guns and 2 locally made light bombs. It destroyed two DC-4s and a DC-3 on the ground and made numerous attacks on ground targets. So this aircraft destroyed two DC-4s and a DC-3 on the ground, and it did some other attacks. And it was flown by a Belgian. So that'll give you an idea of a little bit of combat in an African war by a white guy. Just another point. In this siege battle where this plane actually fought, the people that it fought against was United Nations Irish troops. There were all kinds of troops from the United Nations in the Congo, including lots of Indians and Indian Air Force. But in this particular battle, they actually fought against the Irish. And I want to come back to the Irish. That is a story for another day. But the Irish did extremely well. And what the Irish did there is a rerun of what the Boers did at Blood River, what the Rhodesians did, what the Portuguese did, except that these are Irish troops finding themselves in Africa for the first time. Truly an amazing story, a really amazing story. And some of these things, when we analyze them more closely, we will take a closer and closer look at white troops versus black troops versus non-white troops led by whites. These are very important topics in order to understand racial conflict. So while I may hate the United Nations, I got to tell you, the story of the Irish in this particular battle is a fascinating one. But we'll leave that for another day. I need to get through other things, but we'll come back to this. So an interesting twist of this war that I spotted is that the Katangese government, the government that seceded from the original Congo, that the Belgian government did support them. They did support these rebels. So even though they'd lost their whole colony, they did support the Katangese and the other whites as well. So it was only the United Nations that was against them. It is sad to see times when whites are fighting other whites, but unfortunately in the chaos of Africa, this has happened on certain occasions. And in this particular case, the fight against the Irish is an example. And that Magister jet that went and attacked at that town where the Irish were, the Magister destroyed all the transport aircraft of the Irish. So the Irish couldn't break out. They were under siege, but they did extremely well for themselves, exceptionally well. However, in this sort of brother-to-brother kind of conflict where you've got whites on this side and whites on that side, take note. It is the Belgian pilot with his Magister jet who's causing real problems for the Irish by destroying their transport planes. If he'd not been working for the other side, then those Irish would have been okay, at least in terms of aircraft transport. My point being that the best guys on each side are whites. You've got two multiracial sides fighting each other in a mostly black war, but the best guys on both sides are whites. Imagine if whites did not fight whites. And that's some of the stuff that I'm going to show you, also from Rhodesia and South Africa.
Retaliation in Katanga after Congolese mutineers had opened fire on Belgian troops. The rebels were hiding out in Katanga, which had announced its independence from the rest of the Congo. 4 days were spent trying to persuade the Congolese to give up their arms. They refused, and this was the result. They were rounded up in the bloodiest battle since the Congo mutiny began. Two Belgian soldiers were killed and a number wounded, but 18 of the mutineers lost their lives in this violent house-to-house gunfight. Some 200 were taken prisoner. The United Nations have already sent some 9,000 troops to the Congo to act as a police force. Let's hope they will influence a return to reason and bring an end to such needless bloodshed.
By the way, at this time, with the United Nations being involved, it was a guy called Dag Hammarskjöld, who was a German, who was the United Nations Secretary General. And this guy apparently may have been almost successful in solving this political problem properly. But then he was on a plane flying towards the Congo when that plane crashed mysteriously. And I see that here they've got allegations that maybe some of the Belgians shot down Dag Hammarskjöld's plane. And there has been quite a controversy over his death and suspicions about it. But I'm not going to go into it now. All I'm going to say is that the Rhodesian pilot, whose account we're going to read about Max, that the Rhodesian pilot knows a lot more about what happened to Dag Hammarskjöld, and I think he attributes the crash to an error that the pilots made. And the pilots made a certain approach error, and I think they ended up flying into the ground due to their own miscalculations. But many people have now made this out to be a thing where he died mysteriously, this Dag Hammarskjöld, but there may be no controversy. So while there's nothing of great note here regarding the operations of the Katangese Air Force, what I want to tell you about is a guy called Max. And Max seems to have been waging a one-man war all by himself. So this is what a Rhodesian wrote who was involved in operations in that area and who traveled there with other Rhodesian pilots as they were monitoring the situation relating to that war. So this is what the Rhodesian writes. The Katangese forces were fighting the UN forces with all they had, and one colorful French pilot's exploits came to our notice. We knew him as Max, and I only met him once. He operated a twin Dornier out of a small bush strip, Kipushi, whose 1,000-foot runway was half inside northern Rhodesia and half inside Katanga province. So this guy's functioning out of a little airstrip literally cut out of the bush, and it's actually straddling the border of what is now Zambia and the Congo. So it continues. Most nights Max got airborne for his one-man air war against the United Nations. Crudely applied green and brown poster paint seemed to handle the rainy weather remarkably well, and the camouflage effect was excellent. He employed crudely made bombs that were hand-dropped through an opening cut in the floor of his aircraft. So let me just pause there. So here in the 1960s, you've got this French pilot doing bombing the way that bombing started out in World War I, 50 years before. And he's making his own bombs, dropping them out by hand through a hole in his plane that he's made. And in this war in Africa, it's working. You know, whites in Europe would not even think or consider of doing something like this. Americans and Europeans would never even consider attempting something like this in the 1960s. You wouldn't have done this in World War II. You wouldn't have done this in the Spanish Civil War. You wouldn't even have conceived of it. It would seem so retarded. But in Africa, these things work. And there are many of these things that I want to discuss, because you'll see things working in Africa because the place is so retarded compared to Europe and America. And things which you wouldn't even dare to think of in Europe and America and the rest of the West will work in Africa. And that's a very important point I'm trying to get across to people. And this is also going to be true in the future as non-whites become larger in number. All these weird things are going to work. So let's continue. Max is busy doing his own stuff, painting his own plane, making his own bombs, dropping them out through the bottom of his aircraft. But he's flying at night, attacking the United Nations. So let's continue. Using the gas flame that emitted from its high stack at the Union Minière copper smelting plant near Elizabethville, Max made timed runs to drop two bombs off each pass across the blacked-out UN airbase. He ignored ineffectual searching ground fire and made run after run against unseen aircraft on the ground. So let me just pause there. So he's flying in the dark. He doesn't really have anything he can work with. He's using a flame from the copper smelting plant. This flame is providing light and a reference point for him at night. And he's basically sort of calculating and estimating where he should be dropping the bombs, even though he can't see the United Nations airbase. And they on the ground can't see him, and they're shooting up into the sky, and they're not hitting him. And he knows that they're shooting, but they don't know where he is. So in this crazy situation, let's see what the end results of this are. And it continues. His efforts were well rewarded, in particular the destruction of a UN Globemaster was high return for such crude and inexpensive effort. So he wipes out a Globemaster, which is a very big plane. Now listen to this. When he could, Max drank at bars in Elizabethville, where United Nations forces were present. What guys he employed, I cannot say, but his objective was to find out how his bombing had affected the UN air effort and to glean whatever other information he could. So let me pause there. So the French pilot is a spy. He goes and he drinks with the United Nations guys, asks them questions, probes them, and finds out how well he's doing. And they, of course, have no idea that they're talking to the enemy. So it continues. In doing this, he befriended a helicopter technician who agreed to take him onto the airbase and show him over a small Bell helicopter. Max's casual questions were answered, and he found out how to start the machine. He then awaited an opportunity to steal it. When the right moment came, Max started the engine, and, never having flown a helicopter before, heaved the Bell into the air and wobbled and swayed into forward flight. Let me just pause there. If you've never flown a helicopter before, even if you're a pilot, flying a helicopter is hugely different to flying a normal plane. But here is Max stealing the helicopter and learning as he does his best. So it continues. There were no difficulties with the low-level bolt to the border and Kipushi airstrip, but landing a helicopter is no simple matter, as Max found out when his attempt to hover for the landing ended in a big mix-up as rotor blades beat the airframe to destruction. Max survived the experience and was airborne again that same night in his Dornier to bomb UN planes. So there you've got it. This wild Frenchman is busy fighting the United Nations all by himself, and he's doing his own thing, and he's working alone, and he's achieving some pretty astounding results. So bombing the United Nations aircraft, he's knocked out at least a Globemaster. We don't know what other damage he's done. He's stolen a helicopter, which he's crashed, and luckily he's managed to survive. But he's been pulling off some incredible feats all by himself. And that is just part of what I want to explain to you. As I show you more stuff about racial conflict, you're going to see what white people are capable of. This is just a guy doing his own thing, thinking it up, sort of winging it along, making it up as he goes along. And he's achieving military success against actual enemies who are properly armed. He's fighting the United Nations by himself and getting away with it and giving them a good fucking finger. And I'm all in favor of it. I firmly believe, fuck the United Nations. I fucking hate them. And it's excellent to see how this Frenchman was sticking it to the fucking United Nations back then already. Truly, what a great guy. But I can find no references to Max other than this Rhodesian who writes about him. If anybody ever finds out more about Max, I'd love to know more. I'd love to know what he got up to. Maybe among the French he's known. But yeah, and he's not alone. He's just one of the more colorful people. But I will show you some other things whites have done. And as we get to the more organized situations where whites have got their own countries, have got their own air forces, then you'll see the kind of punch that we used to pack. We really could pack a punch. And the air forces are very important. And I think that the air force that really turned the tide in the war in Africa was the Rhodesian Air Force. The Rhodesian Air Force really got into hectic combat. And the Rhodesian Air Force also lacked and was not allowed to get certain proper military equipment. So we had to use the resources of our state, our little state, and our little bit of science to see what we could come up with. And that in itself is an amazing story. Between Rhodesia and South Africa, the things we got up to, it is a whole different level of ball game. But I just wanted to show you that blacks are fighting each other, and in come a couple of whites, and just a handful of whites already pulling off some serious feats. And this is also in a field where you need a lot of technical skill, which is where the blacks are at a big disadvantage. When you move away from ground combat, and even in ground combat, the blacks aren't that good. When you move away from ground combat, from infantry combat, when you move into other types of combat, artillery, tanks, that kind of thing, then you'll start seeing how the blacks don't do well. And when it eventually gets to much more high-tech stuff like aircraft, then you'll see the whites are in a whole category all by themselves. But I thought this story of Max, the lone Frenchman who waged his own private war against the United Nations, it seems to me that Max was not part of the Katangi's Air Force. He seems to have just been operating by himself, but he was fucking the UN and doing some good damage to them. So I'll drink to Max. What a fantastic guy. And I hope one day we can find out more about Max. But I will show you much more about whites and what whites are capable of. And you'll see, don't fear race war. Don't fear non-whites. Don't bend your knees. You can stand up like a man, and you'll be surprised at how the blacks and others will behave. You do not have to bend down and worship them like the Jews and the liberals tell you to. These people are scum and their plans are bad. You've got to function like a normal white European man. Then you'll see what is possible. You'll see that you can even get non-whites to look up to you and have respect for you, even if you're a freaking racist. That is part of what I will show you. But anyway, Max, what a hero. Awesome Frenchman. And the French play an enormous role in assisting the whites of Southern Africa. The Portuguese, the Rhodesians, the South Africans. The French are there big time. Not so much in military combat, but in terms of assisting us with weapons and science. Big time. France was the only country that really helped us all a lot. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.